Welcome to the Million Vegan Grandmothers podcast. And today we're going to have a conversation, a really beautiful organic conversation that was founded out of interviewing Anita yesterday in regards to the plant-based treaty. And we were talking about the phrase that veganic is actually the true regenerative agriculture, and that we need to bring that out to the forefront. And because Anita was the founder of Plant-Based Treaty, she's always looking for ways to bring truth to the Plant-Based Treaty, and this is one of them. So who did we think of? Ray Kowalczyk and myself, and Anita, bringing her up to par with you, Helen, is you. And we're so grateful to have you here, Helen. And you are the master of veganic gardening, and you show the symbiotic way that you live in nature with your plants. You don't just grow and destroy everything and overtill, but you actually invite all of the life around you into that. So thank you so much, Helen, for being here.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So, can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in veganic gardening and veganic growing? Because you've had a very large veganic operation for many, many years, and you're also a scientist. And anyone that grows well veganically is a scientist, but you have studied in various forms as a biologist, I'm assuming. And can you share with us a little bit about how you got started and what you've learned? Because I hear that the last decade has been a huge growth, learning for you in this area.
It has indeed. I started about 40 years ago farming organically. Well, I guess if you're saying gardening, I started very, very young when I was forced to garden in my mother's garden. But excuse me, as a farmer, I started about 40 years ago and I started organically. And I did what I was taught in graduate school, where I got degrees in horticulture and studied entomology, insects, entomology, and soil science. I did what I had been taught to do, with the exception of trying to figure out how to use organic materials rather than chemical fertilizers and chemicals to control insect and disease pests. And over time, what I found on my farm in Montana is that with the manure-based compost from my neighbor, well, I would get manure from my neighbor who was in Montana. I was surrounded by cattle and sheep ranchers. And then I would add things, plant-based things, and I would spread it every spring. I would till it in, I would plant my plants. Actually, quite a bit of labor involved. And I noticed that despite what I was told in graduate school, I was getting excessive nutrients in my soil over time with my compost addition. And I had developed a system where I had living mulches, plants growing, clovers mainly, in between my crop rows. But I had been told that plant-based fertilizers wouldn't give me any kind of nutrient boost. So I wasn't counting that. I was adding the compost every spring and tilling it in. So with the manure-based compost and with the living mulches, tilled in once every spring and mowed, of course, during the rest of the season, I got excessive nutrients. So that made me rethink everything. And I started very slowly doing experiments. They seem funny now with all that I know 20 years later, but at the time we were afraid we couldn't get enough nutrients to get a good enough crop yield to make a living as an organic farmer. So many years of research, on-farm research, and I was lucky enough to be able to get grants and do that research. I found that I could give up. I first decreased and then gave up the manure-based compost and moved to a completely plant-based fertilizer system. and was moving towards where I am now, which is growing all my own fertilizer or the majority of my fertilizer on farm, which I believe is a regenerative concept. And then I met the love of my life, Carl Rosato, who had a big orchard, or well, a relatively large orchard in organic orchard in Northern California. And though he was not a vegan, he was doing better veganic farming than I was and had been for 20 years. So we got together. I moved to California. We really went crazy with our experimentation and realized we could get away with not spraying any certified organic materials for pest insects and pest diseases. And we just became very radical. And when we finally semi-retired to 211 acres in Eastern Oregon, we wanted to push the ecological limits and see what we could get away with in terms of growing our own fertilizer. And that's when I really started learning what we could get away with. And as my brilliant husband said, when we got the first results, soil test results from a long-term experiment went that we had put in, he said, "This changes everything." And indeed, I continue to learn. And I just wanted to say, Ray, that your wonderful questions about are we learning new things about a carbon-based or a plant-based fertility system? Oh my goodness, yes, it's been a revolution, I would say, the last decade.
It's very exciting because, as part of the vegan movement, we're aware of the idea of phasing out animal agriculture, and we get a lot of pushback that agriculture, animal agriculture is needed, if for nothing else, for the manure. How do you grow crops without animal manure? I mean, it doesn't. It's a bit essentialist to think about how, agriculture is only 10, 12,000 years old. Ecosystems thrived without with just natural processes and natural manures and mostly plant manures, and we're just kind of rediscovering that.
I think that's brilliant. Exactly. Dr. Amir Kassan said, and I actually put this in my book because I thought it was so well said. He said basically, when you take plants, let's say alfalfa and alfalfa grass mix, and a cow eats it and it goes through their ruminant and then they digest it and it becomes to be manure. That's really not very different than cutting a bunch of alfalfa, tilling it in or leaving it on the surface, and having a bunch of microbes process it. We're just missing the ruminant gut. And that's biologically true, actually, it turns out. In fact, I was intrigued on this new farm that I have just downsized to, moving back to Montana. I had the 4 or 5 acres of alfalfa, which at first I was really excited about. So I started building my high tunnel so I could grow year round and have fresh green. And I had this alfalfa that I mowed down and I covered with a tarp and was trying to do no-till, and it started smelling like manure in there. And I realized, oh, the microbes and the decomposition with the tarp on top of that alfalfa, it's really very like applying manure to the soil without the animals. Anyway, that was my experience.
We're involved in this environmental movement that's trying to find all these techno fixes for the problems that we face. And we're discovering again and again that there's usually a natural solution, that we don't need machines to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. We have trees. Those are the machines that have been provided for us. And the processes of farming are obviously something that we think that we've got all sorted out, but you know, your discoveries are revealing that there are things that, you know, may be part of some sort of ancient wisdom, but the science is only just starting to discover what that process, how much more important, say, microbes in our soil are than cows providing us fertilizer, right? The most important animals that we have are microbes, not cows and their poop.
I really think that's true. And I think the new focus, at least in the United States, on soil health, which is to disturb the soil as little as possible and create habitat for microbial communities, is realizing how important these fungi and bacteria and actinomycetes and earthworms, all of the big microbial and other organisms are in making natural nutrient cycling happen. And I just want to touch on what you said in terms of these biological these technical fixes for biological issues that we're coming up with. I am in the process right now of researching, doing a literature review of what the effects of higher nitrogen fertilizers are on the soil and the soil microbial community compared to higher carbon fertilizers, which are fertilizers like growing grasses or clover or alfalfa or these plants that grow and not only have nutrients like nitrogen in them and phosphorus and potassium, but they have all of this carbon, you know, the stuff that makes plants grow upright, you know, the cellulose, all of the heavy, what I like to call heavy carbon. Whereas, of course, manure has much less carbon. So, what organic farmers are trying to do now, and we are questioning, is if you're a dairy farmer, you end up with excess manure. And so you want to utilize that. So, what they end up with is a lot of these lagoons of kind of liquid manure. And what some people and companies are trying to do now is to utilize that because it's a waste product, and they want to make it useful for growing crops. So we are getting some interest in what they're calling non-synthetic ammonia extracts, which they make from either doing something with the liquid manure or drying manure. And then there's this non-synthetic high nitrogen material that could help growing crops. And so some of us are trying to question that and saying that organic farming should be feeding the soil, not the plant, and moving those nutrients naturally through the microbial community. But to put on a non-synthetic liquid ammonia bypasses all of that. So there's a technical fix to getting some use out of all of this manure from dairy operations. And you see where I'm going with this. You could probably finish the sentence for me, couldn't you?
You
Because we
mentioned
wouldn't have
that,
the problem, right? Go ahead.
right? Well, you mentioned that the idea of over fertilizing, and you know, people generally have the idea if a little is good, then more is better. And the idea of putting the nutrients into the soil rather than into the plants. I came across something just doing some of this research, and somebody commented that putting fertilizer into the water means that the plant is going to absorb it through the roots, and it gets it whether it wants it or not. It gets that nutrient, those nutrients. Whereas if you put it in the soil, the plant decides how much it needs, and it's a much more intuitive system rather than you're force feeding plants.
Exactly. It becomes more of a steady state dynamic equilibrium that we add residues to the soil. For example, with my living mulch system where I grow clovers and alfalfa in between my crop rows, I'll mow it. It'll start to decompose with earthworms and beetles and all kinds of other organisms on the surface. It goes down to bacteria and fungi, and they slowly release it into the soil and the soil solution, the water. And then as the plant grows, it takes it up. And of course, the perfect steady state dynamic equilibrium is that it decomposes or mineralizes into nutrients at about the same rate that the plant takes it up. Because if you don't have that steady state, what happens is that things will be released into the soil and mineralized by mineralizing soil bacteria so rapidly that the plants can't take it up. And then we get nitrate pollution in the water. We get ammonia volatilization into the air. And that beautiful nitrogen turns into a pollutant that can make humans sick as well as the land instead of a nice, slow nutrient cycling process. But of course, we don't like anything slow in our human society. We want it fast and we want big, fast plants. And I used to be one of them.
It's
Let me
fascinating
talk
to see
about.
how the soil is almost like our the macro example of agriculture is almost like our own bodies and our gut microbiome. Well, maybe that's a good opportunity to throw back to Tammy. I'm sure she's got some.
Anita, did you have something?
Yes, yeah, that was fascinating. Thank you so much. I read George Monbiot's book, Regenesis, so he had a nice chapter on soil, but this was really enlightening. I was wondering, is your work being amplified? Like, is there an understanding of what you said about plant-based compost systems being optimal on so many levels? Is there an understanding of this concept or this framework in the broader agricultural community, and how, and you know, if it's not broadly understood, what can be done so that this different paradigm, and the one that, you know, Dr. Amir Kassam also mentioned in terms of, you know, it's a different paradigm where you're digesting with microorganisms instead of going through the cow. I think that's a really interesting concept,
Isn't that?
and yeah.
I would have to say no. I would have to say I have been touring with my new book, The Ecological Farm, at many different venues this fall and winter. The organic and sustainable farming conventions. And I do want to say that I had standing room only audiences in many of my presentations, and they were received very well. And a few times people asked me why there were no animals in my system. But generally, people accepted what I was talking about in terms of cover crops and green manures and living mulches and mulches. Does that mean that they accept that that is? Well, I think here's what I'm going to say. Yes, I think from what I can show with my first Montana farm, with the farm that Carl developed in California, and with our farm in Oregon, that we were able to get good yields And really diminish our inputs using a plant-based grow our own fertilizer system. But in general, most of the soil health initiatives in the United States are based now in the last decade, 15 to 10 to 15 years, on animals being part of the system. So I would have to answer your question. The first one, no. I'm excited that in the new US Farm Bill, we are looking to really encourage subsidies for cover cropping. That's a step forward. I think that's a way to think about it. I don't myself know how to change the paradigm that is stronger now than it was 20 years ago, that animals need to be part of a soil fertility system. The only thing I can do is to continue to do my research and show that I can get good yields. And there's others of us. Ian Tolhorst, Ian, who is my hero, whose name I'm not pronouncing properly at the moment, Jimmy Vidalli, and I may not be pronouncing Jimmy's name properly either. Sorry, Jimmy, who is working on the North American, well, has already is pushing forward with the North American Veganic Farming Standards. There are a lot of people doing some great work, but is it the paradigm? Even in organic agriculture, much less, God forbid, in chemical agriculture, I'd have to say no. Okay, so let me not be negative. Let me say, what can we positively do? So positively, I love what you're doing, which is talking about how what we eat changes the world and how we think about where our food comes and how our food is grown changes the world. I'm excited because there's a new area that I'm just starting researching now that seems to there seems to be good data now about how we farm affecting the nutritional and the medicinal quality of our food. So, for example, I came across a wonderful study looking at peach tissue nutrient levels and peaches with high nitrogen had less vitamin C content in them. And the lower vitamin C content in those peach fruits made them more susceptible to a big disease that peaches get called brown rot. Yes, a brown rot disease. I've got so many things in my head. Sorry, I'm starting to forget things. So the beautiful synchrony of that, the beautiful ecological synchronicity of that is that if we fertilize that peach tree with a slower release type of nitrogen so that it doesn't end up with excess nitrate nitrogen in its tissue, it then seems to have higher vitamin C content, which of course is what we need to be nutritionally adequate and to fight diseases like cancer, like you name it, right? But that high vitamin C content is not just for us. It also makes that peach tree, at least in this study I read, less susceptible to a disease of peaches. So I'd like to see more of that research that this carbon-based, plant-based fertility system, as opposed to a rapidly available, grow big green plants, high nitrogen system, may actually increase the amount of antioxidants in the plants that the plants use as a natural defense system. And of course, what do we use antioxidants for? We're finding that that is a very important food as medicine property. I think that we need another revolution over the next decade showing that. And if we can show that these plant-based carbon rather than nitrogen focused fertility systems are the healthiest for the soil and for humans, and maybe even for the plants in creating their own defense systems against diseases and insects, that makes it more compelling, I think. So I hope that was not a downer way of answering your very good question.
That's very interesting. I think in terms of social change, some things could happen as well. So yes, we need that research, which the outcomes make sense, what you said. Something that's good for humans, the planet, and the tree and the soil, or sorry, the plants and the soil. I think that's wonderful. So we need that research. You mentioned some other of your colleagues that are also like leading this effort. And you said you could show the good yields. Those are all part of solutions. How do we go to the do other things that involve working with other groups that can amplify your work? So when will there be a veganic label that should be a mandated, so that people want to buy the veganic produce for all those reasons that you listed? So we need a veganic label. I think there's somebody in Europe who's organizing some sort of association, veganic association in Germany. We met with him.
Yes.
Then you need groups to work with you and amplify. So plant-based treaty can amplify your work. I mean, we have Jimmy Vidal as one of our ambassadors, and we'd love to have you as an ambassador for plant-based treaty. Just how do we amplify, do blogs, do interviews, just like, Tammy's doing right now, like just to amplify your work. That how do you get other groups like PETA, Sierra Club? See, I think all those things need to happen so that they are saying that this is optimal. This is the optimal way to protect the human's health, the animals, the plants, the soil, the planetary health. Like, so this is the optimal. So, and this is the only one that's sustainable in the long term. So I want to see some of that. Like, how do you get groups like the Sierra Club to listen to you? How do you speak to those audiences and so that they advocate and amplify your work?
I agree. I think that's brilliant. We have one slight problem, and it's the same problem that we had in organic 40 years ago, which is hard to believe, but 40 years ago, we were really struggling with how to make organic systems profitable and get enough people farming that there was a lot of produce there, and it wasn't just a niche farmers market product. And I say that with some trepidation because I don't want us going to mega huge acreage organic because I don't think we can do an ecological farming systems approach if it gets to be too large. On the other hand, my goal for 40 years has been to make organic financially available for everyone and not just as a niche market. I'm beginning to see that I'm beginning to see why that is difficult. So back to veganic, we're in that niche market status because we don't have a volume of veganic farmers. And you're going to hate me, but I'm an old lady and I've just downsized. And I am actually not this year going to produce for any others except myself and my friends because I'm in a new system. And I actually have developed a problem that will not be insurmountable, but ironically, 40 years later, a problem that I have never dealt with. And now, as a vegan, I am going to have to address slowly. I am inundated by, because I have this big alfalfa field and I'm surrounded by alfalfa, the system is unbalanced, and I have voles and mice that basically destroyed my crops. So I'm trying to figure this system out without, mass genocide of rodents. So the long story short is that there are still ways of getting, we're still having trouble getting lots of veganic farmers and veganic farmers who can do this on a volume basis so that you could walk into, I'd like to just get to this point soon, that you walk into your co-op and you can get organic grains, organic vegetables, organic fruits, organic beans. Very hard to do right now. So, again, we're seeing that it can be done. I'd like to see it done at a little bit larger scale. This is where some of the veganic people disagree with me and would like to, I know Jimmy would like to see it done on a very, lots of very small scale. I think we need to see it on some 25 to 100 acre size farms as well. Think that we need to figure out the methods. I don't think they're that hard. Ray, you get back to 100 years ago in agriculture. We didn't have all of these ways of moving fertilizers around, and people did have to grow their own fertility. I mean, I'm not actually new on this. I'm like, the science and being able to do it better and more predictably is new, but I think it can be done. We at the moment do not have the number of veganic farmers to feed all the people that I think would actually like to buy veganic. So here's one of the things that some people disagree with me on. I think that we need to have a very high standard for veganic because it's a moral and spiritual as well as biological way of being in the world. On the other hand, I want us to have an alternative to the terrible slaughter of animals and other organisms that we share the planet with, that is what's going on in conventional and even some very, even much better than conventional chemical farming, some organic farming. So I'm torn and I don't quite know what to do. So I stay on my little farm and I try to figure out how to do veganic farming in as profitable way as is possible. And still, this is where I think you could be really helpful with other groups and still make it very clear that my system will never be as quote unquote profitable as a conventional chemical system that brings in all of its off-farm fertilizer and relies on hundreds of ghost acres to produce what it is able to produce on its acreage. The true cost of those ghost acreages, I think, is really vital. So for people like me, where I use land to grow my fertilizer, Ian grows land, uses land that could be put into crops to grow his fertilizer and make and create grow materials to his compost. So on an acreage level, yield per acre, we're always going to be lower, right? But if you look at the cost of our inputs, both financially and environmentally and ecologically and socially, we may be more efficient. Jimmy, I think, would has some thoughts and has done some work to show that yes, indeed, we are. But more of that needs to be done.
That efficiency also, we're thinking in systemic problems of how much land is dedicated to animal agriculture. You phase out animal agriculture, you've got tons of land, so you don't need to dedicate as much land to growing food for humans. So much of it right now is for animals, and there's also permaculture and food forestry and rewilding, just giving some like the half earth solution of giving half the land back to the animals and forests. So it's a
Well,
great piece of the puzzle.
I totally agree with you, and I chose not to bring more humans into the world just for that reason, that I wanted some of my area to be able to be rewilded. I agree with you. I like to think of my farming as permaculture, but we don't have examples of feeding people on a large scale, I think, with permaculture and with veganic farming yet. I think we need those examples. And I also agree with Jimmy in that a way to do that may be to have something that I'm seeing happening, which is a lot of small farms in an area working cooperatively together, sharing equipment, sharing market. So nobody has to be 500 acres. Everybody could be, 20 acres or lots of 5-acre farms. So new ways of thinking about farm communities and distribution communities could certainly help. And Ray, I'm a tree farmer. I love the food forest idea. And yet, at the same time, I see the efficiency in it and I see the challenges in it for feeding people that are concentrated in urban systems, right? I mean, let's face it, part of the reason we have the agriculture system we have in the United States is that everybody went to cities and then we had to feed them in a concentrated way in the cities.
Could we go back to the introduction with that Tammy laid out, and this idea that we need a like a advertising campaign? The real regenerative is veganic, and you said there are some positive measures, like the new U.S. Farm Bill has some positive aspects that would support soil protection. So the plant-based treaty is about all these different solutions, and but you said at this point it's not scalable, it's not being scaled. So if we had a poster campaign, would the objective be to have some positive measures in farm bills, to have economic subsidies to support? So what, because we can't just say, oh, the real regenerative is veganic and it's not available, the supply is not there. So we would have to have goals for the campaign. Is the goal to educate people, to create support for your type of farming? So could you lay out a plan? So if we did have an advertising campaign, and this is brings back to the point of how we bring other groups like the Sierra Club, and we bring all these groups together to support, but we have to look at supply and demand and government support and things like that. So could you just help us with, how do we set the goal? What is the goal of this advertising campaign? What is the messaging? You have some of the photos that we could use. So yeah, if you could help us with that.
Yes, and of course I'm not an expert on this. So I'm going to say that, I'm a biologist, an ecologist. But that being said, I think, and others will disagree with me, that it's a positive thing that because of the soil health initiatives and keeping a growing root in the soil for as long as possible, if not year round, that is moving us slowly into a direction where It looks like in the US Farm Bill, we could be encouraging cover crops. So, yes, I think that encouraging farmers to have cover crops as part of their fertility system at least once every 3 years would help us move away from things like, oh, let's use non-synthetic ammonium extracts, right? It could push us in that direction. On the other hand, some of my wonderful political advocacy people have pointed out to me that what's actually happening, I'm laughing because it's sad, what's actually may happen is that encouraging cover crops may encourage herbicide use in the United States because these no-till farmers are seeing the advantage of cover crops, but they're not organic. So they can use herbicides and they use herbicides to incorporate, get rid of the cover crop rather than the ways, yes. The ways that we would do it organically. So there, that's why I say I'm not an expert in that I don't understand all of the possible consequences of some of these things. Smarter people than I are going to have to do that. However, I do think that we can say, well, let's look at this ecological synergy of dairy farming. We know that we can produce beautiful organic and veganic eventually oats and soybeans. And I'm not going to use almonds here, just, but let's just say oats and soybeans and have these plant-based milks. Then we don't have a problem with the waste material that then has to go back to a concentrated area because you have concentrated cows. And then we're finding that perhaps dairy isn't necessarily good for human adults. So perhaps from a nutritional point of view, nutritional policy, ecological policy, and the fact that you could grow a soybean oat rotation and maybe some other legumes that would help you actually maintain a regenerative, sustainable soil system so that it becomes a big system. Does that make any sense?
It's great information, Helen. And I think what I really hear you saying is it's the education piece. So many people are becoming, I mean, so many more people are becoming vegan. It doesn't necessarily show up in how many animals are being slaughtered every day, but a lot of people are becoming vegan. And I think my vegan people, if they knew that they were taking all this dairy waste and spraying it all over their food, they would want to join in on any veganic movement. So I think in regards to what Anita is asking, it's education. We really need to educate people of what even organic is and what they're trying to pass, and then the truth. The truth, the research, because you have done this research. The research is available. You and other people have done this research. So to have that in a area where people can see the research and on a small scale and a large scale start to move towards veganic.
I think more research is needed. I think that the general paradigm would argue with everything I've done. Just saying, my work is where organic was 40 years ago. And now organic, I feel we still don't have the market share that I'd like to see. I'd like to see us above 25%. but we're really gaining. You know we are. As is veganism. I can walk into a supermarket in Montana, Western Montana now, and I can find vegan products if I weren't growing my food myself. I can go an hour into Missoula, Montana, and I can buy in glass jars that I or glass bottles that I can bring back and recycle. I can get locally produced oat milk from organic oats grown in Montana. I can utilize that. I had stopped utilizing that because I number one, I couldn't recycle those oat milk or almond milk packages that it came in. And number two, I didn't really know where it was coming from. But now I can get oat milk from organic oats. Are they veganic oats? No. Are they organic oats? Yes. And I can return my bottle and not be adding to the waste stream. That's part of regenerative agriculture, I think.
Could I just ask you, like the scenario that you laid out, dairy milk versus plant-based milk, and the plant-based milk coming from a farm where there's rotation between oats, soy, potentially almonds, and
Not
then,
almonds. Almonds.
okay.
Almonds. It's a great idea, but it would be really hard to. It's really hard for people to do that. But let's say they could grow soybean, corn, and or a brassica. You know, something in the middle.
Maybe hemp.
Right, and oats. You know, so part of their crops would be vegetables or anyway. Sorry, I'm being too.
Yeah, but you even mentioned legumes. You said like, yeah, so it could be like rotation between oats, soy, you might have some legumes there. So you'd have this system, this farm. Are you saying that that farm would be veganic? Could be veganic, or it certainly would push in that direction.
It certainly could be. It certainly could be if you had a cover crop that was, say, a mix of clover and some grasses, and then you grew another legume, which is soybeans. You got your crop of soybeans, and maybe you got your crop of corn, and maybe you got your crop of oats. You could have a system that sponsors its own soil fertility, that grows its own fertilizers. We would need to subsidize that because it's more expensive to take the land out of production and put it into a cover crop or green manure that's growing your own fertilizer than it is to graze that system with animals and be allowed to turn your animals into an economic crop, which we don't want, or I don't want, but you see where I'm going with that. I'm being hard-headed and economically realistic. Thank you.
So it's like when the animal ag people say that are trying to come up with a solution, their system is could be very similar, except they have the animals graze, whereas you're saying just leave the land alone. So you're saying that's how we just they're similar systems, so we just improve on the system without the animals, but they would need subsidizing too, wouldn't they, for that system? And we would need subsidizing.
Good point. And see, that's where I'm not an expert. I do not know all of the subsidies that are going into animal agriculture. It's just not my thing. But I know that they're there. If we transferred some of those subsidies and we said, okay, we're going to leave that land it for 10 months into cover crop, we're going to let it bloom profusely. We're going to encourage pollinators, right? Pollinators and beneficial insects. And that's a good that we can subsidize for. And then we're not going to do as much no-till. We're going to till that in. And then we're going to grow our crops. And then we're going to grow another crop. And then we're maybe going to have another cover crop. It's a just subsidizing for different priorities. And again, this is not my area of expertise. I am not a political advocacy person.
Well, thank you so much, Helen. I think our conversation is going to continue as we teach and promote that the real regenerative is veganic. And thank you, Anita, and thank you, Ray, for being here. Do you have a copy of your book you could hold up? It's called The Ecological Farm. Is that
I do.
great? That would be great. And Anita, beautiful. So when did your book come out, Helen?
It came out last June. June, and Chelsea Green is the publisher. And as I said, I have been doing a lot of podcasts and a lot. I was on a regenerative agriculture panel in Denver. I was the only veganic farmer on the panel. But there you have it. I'm just going to end with saying, I really like the idea of educating people as to what they're really eating and what it means, even when it's organic, which I love, and what it would take to change our subsidy priorities in the United States, to move us to a more plant-based and finally to a veganic farming system, and why that's important. And not, you're already doing that. But man, that I don't think people have any idea. I didn't know about synthetic ammonia extracts. And I'm the high nitrogen, compared to high carbon queen. And I didn't know about that. And that's the other thing that we could perhaps do very gently, not stridently in any way, because we want to support organic. But if we come out and say, wait a minute, organic is high nitrogen fertilizer? But what about the nitrates? This isn't good for us. Lots to do, isn't there?
Well, thank you for continuing to do it, Helen. And thank you, Ray and Anita, for being here. And the conversation will continue. So the ecological farm, if you haven't found Helen's book, please do. I know it's going to be loaded with information and how-tos, and go forward and multiply the message of the education of what is actually going on with our practices.